You could make good money on tomatoes, if you could, but you had to have perfect tomatoes. I mean perfect. And the only way you get perfect tomatoes, as far as I'm concerned, is you got to spray it. And a lot of this, I'm all in favor of organic and stuff, but a lot of this organic stuff you see in the store, 20 years ago, they throw it down because of the looks. Mm-hmm. And they didn't care about the nutrient. They just wanted to look good.
Right.
But you can ask him, we had, when you took a load of tomatoes to the packing house, they had to be right, didn't they?
They sure did.
I used to catch all mine and throw out tomatoes and bring them home and sell them for candy.
Mm-hmm.
I did everything in the world to make a living. And, it worked for me. I've made it. Well, now I've worked at DuPont twice in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of college. Well, I dropped out of college, went to work at DuPont way back in the 60s. And then Uncle Sam got me. Vietnam was just starting.
Right.
I got drafted in the Marine Corps. And I stayed in the Marine Corps for 3 years. Bobby was in the Navy. But after I come out of the Marine Corps, I went back to DuPont and still farmed full time. Pretty big way, 100 head of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
Still work a job. Me and my brother's always been that kind of crazy stuff. That's why I'm so broke down, I guess. But then in 76, I got the idea, I'm going to try farming full time. So I quit DuPont under good circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I went to him and told him, look, I'm going to work for myself for a while, but I may want to come back one day. I farmed full time for 14 years. And then I got so wore out of it, I went back to DuPont in 89 and worked 12 more years. And ended up getting a pretty good retirement from those two. Well, I ended up for a little over 25 years. Right as DuPont shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky. But when I was farming full time, that's when Bobby, let's see, yeah, I quit in 76 and you started growing tomatoes about, 77, 78?
No, I came back in 78.
78. I was farming full time then. Then later on, I got a chance to work for Campbell Soup Company as a field rep. And we had a lot of crops over in Hardin, over there.
Mm-hmm.
Taproot Dairy and
yeah.
Carlin's. Over at Carlin's.
I know both of those, yeah.
Whitaker, we had the, and on Biltmore State, we had 300 acres of potatoes and carrots on Biltmore State. And I was the field rep, kind of the go-between the farmer and the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in charge of all the trucking and all that kind of stuff. And I had to check the fields twice a week, scout the fields for diseases and pests. Campbell Soup was very strict. Tractor trailer load of potatoes. If they found one bug or one worm or a dead fly in that truck, they rejected the whole load. And boy, we had to be careful because the freight just getting a load of potatoes down there to the plant was almost $1,000. And if you got turned down, you had to pay freight back. But we worked out a deal with the state of North Carolina, the Caledonia Prison. Rejected loads went straight to Caledonia Prison. And they got a cannery at Caledonia Prison. Caledonia is a big prison.
Where's that?
Way down Low Raleigh somewhere.
Okay.
Caledonia. But anyway, we ended up getting more money out of Caledonia Prison than we did Campbell City. So after that, we didn't worry too much. Any rejected load, the truckers knew to take it straight on to Caledonia Prison. Carrots and tomatoes. Potatoes.
Wow.
I did that for about 6 years too. And farmed my own stuff. I grew 150 acres for them. And then I had 200 head of cattle during that time. And I did all that on my own. I had a little bit of hired help now, a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting, but I don't want to do it again.
Don't blame you.
But I've been cattle business all my life. I'm sold out now. I've got three head. You know, prices are sky high right now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have sold right now. I I've got a cousin up here that's got a lot of cattle, and I help him a little bit. But I'm mainly on the coast and down.
Are you recording?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Better start from scratch. What you're born and your name and your letter.
We'll get to that eventually. It was so good, I didn't want to miss any of it.
Well, I was raised on a farm. I've been around farming. My daddy runs a little dairy farm. And I've been around it all my life. Mm-hmm. And when we talked about working in a public job, that was 8 or 12 hours a day. We came home and did another 6 or 8 hours.
Right.
And during the time I was in there, after the second time, I worked 12-hour shifts at DuPont and took care of 250 head of cattle.
Wow.
But I had a boy help me. And then 93, when we had the big blizzard, you know,
mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a terrible day. Couldn't get feed the cattle, and I was working nights.
Are you cold? You want to go in the other room?
No, I'm fine. I just didn't take my coat off.
Same
I
here.
Can do it.
I'm okay.
We'll get comfortable.
Thank you.
Yeah, we were both born in 93, so we remember stories of the
right.
blizzard.
Oh.
So at least my mama likes to talk about it because she was pregnant during it and was so scared, you know. Oh, gosh,
well,
what if she's
rough.
Born in
it
the blizzard?
It was a rough day. It was a rough day. The thing about 93, it came and went. In other words, we had that terrible blizzard. And a lot of places, we had drifts of snow 10 foot deep. And it blew. The wind blew all day. But I remember winters worse than that. In 1962, I was a teenager. And in the month of March, it snowed every Wednesday in the month of March. We got up to 20 inches of snow on the ground. It got to 20 below zero at night. And the ground got so hard, the snow got so hard, that a horse could walk on top of it.
Yeah, that's pretty hard.
But you know, if you watch WLOS, they don't have no record of it. They said the other day, 14 below zero was the record that's ever been around here. I remember 20 below zero every night for 3 solid weeks
oh
in 1962.
Your goodness.
I don't know why they don't have records of that. But it was the roughest year I ever remember in my life. And see, it was just now starting. This is just the first, tomorrow's first March, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all this didn't start till the first of March.
Gosh.
We had snow that year into all the way into May, and the snow was still on the ground. But it was rough. Me and my brother were teenagers, and we had about 100 head of cattle. We ran out of hay. And back then, we didn't have all these pickups and trucks. Daddy had an old car with a trailer hitch on it. We pulled it down to Longview Strait, and there was a man down there who had a bunch of hay in the barn. And we hooked the trailer to his tractor and pulled it to the barn, loaded it up, pulled it back to the road, and pulled it on home with that old car. That's the way we did it all that. And then 73 was a real bad winter. 93 was a rough 2 days because of the way the snow came down.
You know, it must have been a lot more rough up here because at that time we were living over there at Horseshoe.
In 93?
Yeah, 92. 91. We came here in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 92. And, you see, I don't know when we moved up here.
Well, your daddy owned this land the way on back there.
Yeah, I don't know if he bought it now. I think he bought it in 61.
I was going to say, because when the Cook Boys had corn down here.
Yeah, that's when.
That's when they had trouble with that old man that built these houses out here.
Yeah.
He threatened to shoot them and everything, bringing the combine. Didn't have your driveway. You had to go up and come out one of his driveway. Oh, he come out there with a gun, threatened to shoot it or something.
Who's this now?
The old man that built all these houses.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who it was.
Is that right?
Yeah,
they didn't tell me about that.
He gave them a fit that year, but they had everything here in corn.
Hmm.
They had a real good crop.
Yeah, we 61 came here. I was born in Okinawa, Japan. My father's from here in Canada, and my mother's from Japanese. And I was going to a Christian school. I went to 2 years of Japanese school. My father trying to get me to learn Japanese. I didn't do too good. Then he finally put me to, back in the American Christian school. Then we came over here when I was 14 years old, 1961. But living in Okinawa, at that time, it wasn't Japan. It was Ryukyu's Island. It was under American jurisdiction, sort of after World War II, right? But living there, it was just like, I guess, half in the States and half in Japan, because they had so much military base, American there, and I thought that was normal.
See, I went through there when I went to Vietnam.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was our transit. We went to Okinawa and stayed about 3 days.
What year was that?
Well, when I went through Vietnam, that's 66, 67.
Oh, 67. I was 14 years old.
66, are you? 66. The war really started about 60. The summer of 64, we knew the war was going to start. Because I was working for State Highway, and we heard on the radio that evening that there was that, now they say it wasn't even so, that Gulf of Tonkin deal, which they say now that wasn't even, didn't even happen. That started in Vietnam War. They were looking for an excuse to
start have a war. Yeah, I heard that too.
But I went on to college in the fall of 64. And when I dropped out of college, I knew I'd get drafted. I mean, everybody was getting drafted. Unless you were married or you were really in college and all that. A lot of boys got married just to stay out. But anyway, I didn't care. I just wanted to. When I went in the Marine Corps, they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I have no idea. I don't care. I said, I just want to see the world. Well, I saw the world. But I got into a good field in electronics, and they just happened to, well, they took tests. And they put me in aid in the air wing of the Marine Corps. And I went through a real good electronics school. And then I spent my time in the Marine Corps working on fighter planes in Chulai, Vietnam. Then I came home, and with all that training I had, I went right to DuPont as a control mechanic, which is one of the best jobs you can have out there as a wage drill worker. Mm-hmm. And, but I spent time at Okinawa going over, and when we flew out of Vietnam coming home, we came back to Okinawa. We left all of our good clothes in Okinawa.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and we picked all
another
stuff
transit
up.
Point. Well, you know, they had one of the best military hospital there because, you know, emergency, they flew them to Okinawa, yeah. Basically.
But, you know, it's kind of like a bad dream. When I was over, the Second World War had only been over 20 years. And I worked in a cafeteria that had KP union in Okinawa one time. There was men working in that cafeteria that had been fighter pilots for the Japanese during the war.
Yeah,
yeah. You'd sit down and try to get them to talk to you, and some of them would talk, some of them.
I met a few of those, and they were bragging. They were kamikaze pilots. We would ask them, how come you're still alive?
My brother never went to the military, and he was already had cattle, and my daddy had cattle. So I got married, and then I just kind of grew into the cattle business. And up until 2 years ago, I've had cattle all my life, but I've got three now. This valley up through here used to have a lot of cattle. We have a pretty serious threat of flood, you know, right down at Horseshoe. We're better off here than they are down at Horseshoe and Blantyre. Mm-hmm. Up here, it comes and goes real quick. And we have a lot of current, swift water up here. Mm-hmm. Down there, it backs up in the fields and just sits.
Looks like a lake some days.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, on some of them roads over there, like Banner Farm Road. Some of the roads, sometimes they're underwater for a week. But normally within 2 days, the water's gone up here. Mm-hmm. You have 12 hours. But we have to put up with that, because when you're farming, you've got beef cows with baby calves way down in a 100-acre field on the riverbank, and the water, it rains and rains and rains. If them cows don't come out on their own, or you go get them, there's places in between where our barns are and the river that is actually real low. And we can have water 12 foot deep in places, and the riverbank still not got water in. And then cattle go to that riverbank and stand them. And then when it really comes on up and covers the whole thing, they know which way to go. We've seen them walk right out in the river and get washed on down. But normally, one time I had to go down there during the flood, had baby calves and everything. I never felt so sorry for baby calves in my life. I was driving them out, and a little bitty baby, just 2 weeks old, was trying to swim. Its mama was still walking on the ground. It was going through a low flood. And that little booger got tired and started losing ground. Now, you won't believe this, but the mama got behind the baby and pushed her on it. That's natural instinct. It was amazing. I saw it because I was right there with it. These floods can ruin a good crop, or they can be all kind of scary.
Yeah, when you're a farmer, you can have that flood, and on top of that, I remember one year down here, you had a hailstorm and laid that corn stalk down.
Yeah, farming ain't easy, huh? I'll tell you right now. You got to have a few good years to keep yourself going. There's not many people around here do it for a living. And you go to Haywood County, and some of them counties over there, well, they don't even have as much flat land as we do. There's more people in Haywood County make a living farming than there is here in Charleston County. We got lots more level land. But them old boys over there, they're just used to farming little old patches, and they make a living.
Why do you think not as many people farm around here?
We had too many plants for a long time. We had a Coosta plant over, and then DuPont came in here in 1957. When I got out of high school, you didn't have to worry about getting a job. You'd get a real good job without a college education. And if you had a college education, you could really have a good job. And it was that way for years and years. And, of course, a Coosta started in 1937, I believe. They got up to 5,000 people, and DuPont got up to 3,000. Well, that's 8,000 families being taken care of by them two plants. And people just realized they could go work in a plant and make a whole lot more money and not have any worries and chance of losing everything. So my daddy sold out of the dairy business and went to work at DuPont. It was just kind of natural for me and my brother, and we both worked. My brother started out at Acosta, but he worked down there 7 years, and then he went to DuPont. Well, I went to DuPont right after one semester at NC State. Mm-hmm. And then I had a sister who worked out there a little while. Well, our whole family worked at DuPont. But you're talking good money compared to other jobs. We don't have them now, that's why y'all over around Arden have got a lot of plants. Mm-hmm. And we don't have nothing except a few beer cans. And the old American Thread plant, which is just hanging on in Excelsior. Old Mitchell Bissell up at Rosman is probably the safest plant. It came in here the year I graduated, 1964. And it's been steady ever since. But they're small, they only work 150 people. And they get out and, see, they make carts for other companies. Lawnmower companies, chainsaw companies, car companies. And they got people that's out there trying to find the product that they can make for some company. They really get out there and dig, and they keep that plant going. It's not the highest pay, you know, $12 an hour. Where at DuPont, when I finally retired, I was making $20 an hour. But I saw y'all are getting something new over our Mills River. It said 140 jobs, and they're going to help start a salary, $55,000 a year. Supposed to be coming in about a year. I don't know what he. See, y'all are close to the interstate.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not. And that's why we don't get these big industries. DuPont didn't want to be close to anybody. When they came here in 1957, they were looking for a clean environment and clean water. Because they started out making silicone, which, you know, they back then transistors were just coming in. And transistors were made out of silicone. Well, DuPont really got in on the ground floor making silicone. And they built a plant out here and hired 200-300 people. But then the Japanese figured out how to do it too. And they started making it for 50% of what DuPont was making. So they had to shut the silicone plant down and not run for 2 years. But then they brought x-ray film in. And that's what kept it going for 30-something years.
Mm-hmm.
And then digital took over x-ray. But we was talking this morning. You go to the doctor, you still see a lot of film.
Mm-hmm.
Even on MRIs and stuff, they still put a lot of stuff on film. But the United States is out of that now. See, the Agfa company bought DuPont out. They got about 70% of the world market. Anyway, we tried farming and doing all that too, and that's how I'm just used to it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of work.
You know, back then, how many dairy farms were they running?
Oh, in 1952, there was 23 dairy farms in Transylvania County, but they were small. My daddy milked 25 cows. The Whitaker boys off Mills River came and got our milk. But they didn't have a pumper, you know, a tanker truck. We put it in them big old cans. And them boys would come to 4 o'clock in the morning and pick up our meal. From the whole day, 2 milkings the day before. And they was eating a dairy in Balsam Grove.
Is that right?
The Kitchens family up there had a dairy.
You know, down here near, say, Harmony Corner, that silo, did they have a dairy there?
No, that was built by Eddie Varner. He bought this place at one time. And he was a big cattleman. He's the same one that built the big barn, the big pretty barn over on Walnut Island.
Mm-hmm.
He put that silo in.
Oh, exactly.
He fed cattle down there in that plant. Hmm. He built that silo. That's so, when there's a company come through here. We got a silo the same year. Some company from up in my Iowa or somewhere came through here building silo. Back then everybody had to have an upright silo. Within 10-15 years it was obsolete. Everybody was digging a pit in the ground, put the silo in the ground because you could load it with front end loaders. With them things there, you either had to have a silo unloader or get up there and we every day, me and my brother climbed that silo. We got in there with a corn fork and threw it out.
And that wasn't too safe either, right? The gas sometimes.
We didn't pay no attention.
You get drunk in there. Yeah,
well, they say now it's dangerous.
Yeah.
We didn't pay no attention.
Is that right?
We did a lot of things back then. That's just like going to school. I drove a school bus for 3 years. Well, we'd have gone to school every day this week back in the 60s. The drivers had to put chains on school buses. Nowadays, if it's a little sleet out there, anyone knows. I have driven to school with a whole load of kids, and I mean I was only in the 10th and 11th grade, driving a great big old bus, and get to school, and it was so slick at Rosamond, you had to go up this ramp up to the high school, and the elementary was over here. And I got my load of kids all the way to the top of that ramp one morning, and that bus started sliding back. It slid all the way back to the lower end of the highway. And Mr. Tilson, the principal, he was out there watching me. Oh, he was worried about it. He said, back on across the road over to the cafe. There's Lance's Cafe right across the road. He said, Mike, put your chains on and take them home. Well, they had timed us. We carried a 6x6 block of wood in the bus. You pulled your wheel, the inside wheel up on that 6x6, that left the outside wheel free.
Mm-hmm.
You could throw a chain, set a chain down in just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did the other side. And we were teenagers. And 80% of all school bus drivers back then were students. Mm-hmm. And we had a better record back then than the adults. But if you got caught anything speeding, or if you were involved in accident, it didn't even have to be your fault. It took your driver's license, your bus driver's license. Man, we had to walk the chalk line. But it was something else. Somebody was talking about that yesterday. Nowadays, they just look for excuses to close the school. I don't know what it is.
Well, most of the boys, they grew up on a farm. They had a little common sense.
I really think it had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I was smarter than anybody, because I wasn't. But I just knew how to do all that stuff. And why my little nephews now, they don't do nothing compared to what I do. It's funny. Of course, my daddy was right there making me do it. My mama taught school for 45 years. And so I was involved. She made sure that we did what was right. But anyway, I don't know if you're going to get much out of this or not, the way I'm rambling.
Oh, we got it. That's perfect.
It's great. How these stories are perfect. Yeah.
And you know, when you go to, when I quit DuPont, we had real good insurance, the health insurance at DuPont. Mm-hmm. And in 76, I quit. I told them I wanted to try farming full time. No insurance, no nothing. You know, you couldn't afford to buy insurance. You weren't making no money. And I remember I had two bad accidents. I was working on a Wisconsin motor. You never did see that old big backhoe I had that was on the tractor trailer truck. But it had a Wisconsin motor running the backhoe part. And the shaft was exposed where you were coming out the front. Because you could put, it had an electric starter. But I got my knee into that thing one day, and it just eat my knee in.
Ew.
I didn't even go to the doctor. Then one time I was feeding corn in a hammer mill. And a hammer mill is a machine that just flies. It's got a big old hammers in it, big old steel pieces. And it just, it goes like 6,000 RPM. You feed corn into ear corn, and it grinds it up, corn, cob, shuck, and all. And that's real good cattle feed. Well, I was grinding corn one day, real cold day. I mean, it was like 10 degrees. And I had a pair of, of course, I had my underwear on. I had a pair of long johns on, a pair of blue jeans on, and then a set of coveralls over top of all that. Well, there was a six-cylinder motor driving that hammer mill. And I didn't have a cover on that shaft, a little dry shaft about that long. Had a universal joint in, and I got a little careless, and I got my right leg into the, right under the knee. I backed into that shaft going 6,000 RPM. Immediately, I was standing there with nothing but underwear. I mean, I don't remember nothing. And when it did, jerking all them clothes off, it jerked the calf muscle loose from my leg. Well, I didn't have no insurance. I didn't go to the doctor. I laid at the house for a week. Man, that thing was throbbing just like that, you know, your tiny heartbeat. It turned red. And I put my leg up on the back of the couch, and it helped a little bit. And then finally, after about 4 days, it started developing these red streaks. And I knew I was getting blood. It looked like blood poisoning or something. I finally went to Dr. Sanders. He said, how long ago did this happen? I said, about 5 days ago. He said, well, nothing I can do now. I said, if it ain't killed you by now, you're going to be all right. And he charged me $20 for sure. And then a big old bull got me one time, got me down on the ground. Ooh. And this bull, I'd raised this bull. It was a Holstein bull. You can't trust Holstein bull. Big old thing, weighed 1,400 pounds. And I was down in the field by myself, and I was taking some salt down. I had a salt feeder down there, pouring it in. That old bull come up to me, and I reached around, rubbed his head. He's just a nice, thick bee. And I turned around and finished putting that salt. He landed under my hip, and he knocked me plumb under that feeder. And he stood there looking at me. And if he could have got to me, he'd have killed me. Finally, he turned around and walked off. I got rid of that. I could have broke my head, but it didn't. It didn't. I didn't go to the doctor then either. Anyway, it's been interesting.
Yeah, now if you get a little cut in your finger, you want to go see a doctor. Get it out.
I'm having bad back problem. I had to have back surgery last March, and it worked pretty good for about 3 months. And I guess I did more than I should have on the farm. They fused some of my vertebrae together, and they didn't took no steel. Now they tried a new procedure. Dr. Hicks at where he's on his joint. He went in there and cut out a lot of bone, and he ground all of it up and mixed it with cement and packed it back in there, and he said it was going to fuse these two weird vertebrae together. It's kind of a new procedure. Well, it worked pretty good for a little while. Then I started having pain again. I went over there about 3 months ago and got another MRI, and all that's broke loose. I don't know what I'm going to do now. That's why I'm working with Steve.
Yeah, that was just a year and a half ago, wasn't it?
No,
yeah.
About a year ago, because March the 3rd was when I had surgery.
And you didn't have, you had pain, but you didn't have any problem. You were working.
I got out here and cut hay on, but that's probably a lot of my problem. Yeah. If I'd done nothing all summer, I'd have probably been all right. But I can't do nothing. I got to get out. The only reason I know Bobby Marcy's so good, Marcy takes care of my house. That's why she takes care of my house. My wife took off and left me about 9 years ago. My wife got two. Did you see my dogs in the car?
We did. We pulled up and we said, "What is in that car?" And then it looked at us and we said, "It's a dog."
That's what I live with.
They were so sweet. They were just looking at us.
That's
like,
his baby.
That's my baby.
You
have
two very beautiful children.
Oh, well, I want to take good care of them too. I run over one of them on last week. And, oh, I thought I'd killed it. It didn't break a bone, but he's awful sore. When I pull in Bobby's driveway out here, that dog knows where I'm going. He wants to get out. And he'll run ahead of the car for a little while. Then he'll come back to the car and bark at the left front wheel. You know, you can't even see him. And that's what he was doing up at my house. And only he got too close. I run plumb over top of him, going up the hill. I didn't take him to the doctor for 2 days, so I thought he was all right. I got worried that his bladder was busted because he hadn't gone to the bathroom in 2 days. And I took him up there, and luckily nothing was wrong, but the doctor got $280 out of him.
Yeah, animal cost just as much as a human patient.
Oh, yeah. They even sell dog insurance, dog and cat insurance.
One of my friends has that. She told me that, and I laughed. I said, I never heard of that before.
You go to the vet, you can spend $200 or $300 just on the dog. They x-ray them. They do everything that they do at the hospital to people. Used to be, you know, we had a little vet come out to the farm. He'd charge you $30 to work on a cow. Why do you take away no more? Now, there's very few people in this county. There's a couple boys down at Little River. Well, I can't say they make their living totally farming, though, because a lot of the farmers, like me, I used to have a dump truck and backhoe and front end loader. I haul gravel in the wintertime just to supplement my income. Because they want a lot of income from farming, unless you had a real good year. Now, in the early 70s, we started growing trellis tomatoes. And for about 2 or 3 years, we made real good money on 3 or 4 acres, just a few acres of trellis tomatoes. Boy, there's a lot of work in it, too. But then here come the Mexicans. And them Mexicans started growing tomatoes, and they was happy to make 10 cents on the dollar. We was trying to make dollar for dollar. And I don't know. Them people work so hard. They're hard workers. I got really... But they just flooded the market with tomatoes. Now, Mills River's full of tomatoes. It's all Mexicans. There's a few guys that say they're tomatoes, but really the Mexicans. A lot of them own all the tomatoes. When Robert Warren was over there, he just contracted the big Mexican people to come in there and grow all them tomatoes. He went to the penitentiary. The guy that started growing all them tomatoes over there, he spent 6 years in the penitentiary over there. He got caught frogging. He had real good crop insurance on them tomatoes. One summer, his tomatoes wasn't worth much. Now, this is what they say really happened, and I believe it because I knew Robert. He had like 600 acres of tomatoes in Mills River. He went in there and had them Mexicans just to beat a whole 4 or 5 acres, just go through there with sticks and beat them. And then he had a truckload of ice, and they scattered that ice and took pictures. The hail damage. he got paid hail damage, total loss. On like 300 acres of tomatoes. I mean $200,000 to $300,000 from federal crop insurance. And somebody turned him in and they took him to court and proved that what he did. Somebody ratted on him. And he spent 6 years in the federal penitentiary. And he built that one of them packing houses down on the river down there, and he was had another place over in Sardis Road over there. Where he sold stuff, and he was a wheeler digger. But now the boys that's growing all that now, or they're growing it for these boys, the Johnson boys from Hendersonville, not the Johnson Dairy and Mills River, the Johnson Produce family, Mutt Johnson, they even spell their name different. Those two families are not kin to each other. And Mutt Johnson, the old man, but he still runs a produce packing house out on, I believe it's Hard Jeff Road. But his two nephews are doing all that farming there in Mills River. And they've got two packing houses. One of them is dedicated to organic. Down close to where y'all live, I guess it's on, you go by the where they rebuilt the Mills River Elementary School, and go on down, there's a new packing house on the right, that's the organic packing house. And right in front of the school, if you turn left at that red light, you go down and that's the regular big, and it's totally dedicated to Bilo. They sell everything for Bilo. And they run year-round. They probably run over today. They ship stuff up here from Florida and Mexico and pack it over there for Bilo. Them two boys, they bought my tomatoes for several years. And they were just a little, they had a little old packing house in Andersonville. But then they got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they'd gone through some tough times, but them boys was worse than that. But they were raised in a produce family. My daddy used to grow produce here back before they had refrigeration. And we didn't have Mexican workers then. We had blacks. He had a bus, he ran the Boulevard. Every morning he got a busload of workers. And they hauled their produce, Dad did, to 6th Avenue in Hendersonville, where the old depot, down below M&M freezer lock. I used to go down there with a kid, I was a little old, 7-year-old kid. They had freight cars, railroad cars, and they had ice, a big block of ice all the way down the middle of those freight cars. And they'd pack their produce on each side of that ice. And they'd ship over to Atlanta or Miami. They'd leave that night and get there the next day. No kind of refrigeration except ice. That's back in the late 40s and early 50s. That was fascinating. And at night, you'd go over there at 6th Avenue, there'd be 200 farmers' trucks parked there getting ready to unload. Now there ain't nothing going on. But it was amazing one time, that little area right in there where that train stopped. And it just from farmers. They Nobody hardly remembers that, I mean. It would be nice if somebody researched that and had some old pictures and stuff of how that industry got started in the industry. And it was some produce companies out of Florida, J.W. Johnstone and Cornelius and Sons. And they're the big ones that come up here and did all that farming. But they didn't ship it on trucks like they do now. They ship it on railroad.
Then they had grew flowers too, right?
Oh yeah, Maychick come in here. That was in the... Was that after you come back here?
I don't even know.
I believe that was in the early 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think probably 72, somewhere along through there.
Maychick and some outfit out of Florida come into this area and bought a big chicken. Oh, we used to have a big chicken industry in this county too. At one time, like, a lot of farmers made their living growing chickens here back in the 50s. I had an uncle up here that was had a monster chicken house up here at Cherryfield, and he sold it to Maychick. Maychick was the group Gladiolus, and they rented this whole place. They probably had 2,000 or 3,000 acres in Transylvania County of Gladiolus, and they come in there during the day and cut them. They cut them things before they opened up, and they'd take them up out of that, the old chicken house, which they turned into a packing facility. And they'd ship 3 or 4 tractor trailer loads of flowers out here every day. And then there was a little place in Mills River, Bradley, right there at the, let's see, you know the big red light when you get into Mills River, where the 191 and 280 meet and everything? There's an old farm right there on the left. It's growed up now. There's a big old building that used to be Bradley Farmers. He grew flowers over there. And I don't know what's happened. That whole family must have all died out because the place is just growing up. Nobody's took it over or nothing. It looked like somebody would buy it. It's right there beside that grocery store. What is that, Food Line back in there? I believe it is the Food Line.
Yeah, it's the Food Line
it's
back
right
there.
Right before you get to the Food Line.
There's that car wash and the bank there now.
Yeah. Old man Brad. I can't, let's see, we had the dairy industry, we had the chicken industry probably first, and then we had the dairy industry in this county. And then the Gladiolus come in, and then later on we started a pretty good little tomato growing in this county. We had 1,200 acres in this county at one time. And a lot of the boys, and then the fish industry, we had a big trout growing. They steal some trout, but at one time in Transylvania County, produced second most trout in the United States. But that's when Charles Ziegler and everybody, oh, that's a place we were up in Cathus Creek. The old man Charles Ziegler, he started the trout industry in this county. But he's way up in his 80s now, he shut his place down. He's got a son that still runs a trout place up on Balsam Grove. He's got 2 trout farms up there. So he had his own hatchery and everything. But now, you talking about some history. Charles Ziegler can tell you some history. And he's got his basement. It's a big museum. He was big to get out in the evenings and walk the woods and pick up arrowheads and stuff. He's got thousands of arrowheads. Tommy Hawks. Now, he's bought a few collections. But it's amazing. You've never seen that.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, Charles is still alive.
I'd like to go see him. I didn't know that.
Well, if you want to go up there one Sunday, we'll drive up there one Sunday. Because they told me, like, I saw him somewhere. Oh, I saw Jeanette when I ran over my dog. She was up at the dog pen, up at the dog hospital. Charles's little dog died, and she got him a new dog. She told me to come see him. Some Sunday, we'll drive up there.
I didn't know he'd
You wouldn't believe that. Collection he's got. But he used to have the prettiest trout farm. It was on the head of Cathus Creek. Now Cathus Creek is also the water supply for Bavar. Mm-hmm. Charles was there first. And they couldn't make Charles, in other words, all the water that went across the fish went right on through the large water plant. Well, they purify it and all that. But they didn't want anything up there, but they couldn't run Charles out because he was homesteaded in. But he's quit growing. He grew the little fish from eggs. And he had a whole big building dedicated to just hatching fish. And he grew like 10 million at a time. It was amazing. And at one time back when I was farming, they even started processing trout up there. And they had this old big refrigerated truck, and they talked me into driving that thing. I left Bavard every Monday morning at noon. They brought the truck to my house. Now, I was still farming, too. This was another one of them projects, just to make a little more money. And I'd take that truck, I'd head toward Atlanta at 12 o'clock on Monday. I'd hit Atlanta at 4 and 5 o'clock in the evening, right in the middle of traffic. And I had to make 5 drops uptown in Atlanta with this big old truck. Oh, Lord, it was terrible, the traffic. And then after I made my 5 drops, I come on back down and hit the interstate and went all the way to Lakeland, Florida. I'd get to Lakeland, Florida at 2 o'clock the next morning. I'd unload the whole, they had people down there helping me. We'd unload that whole truck. They had me a little cot to sleep on. I'd go to sleep about 3 o'clock in the morning. Sleep till 7 o'clock. Get in that truck and come all the way home. And I thought, man, I can do that and still do all my farming. You'd like to kill me.
Well, when you're young, you can.
I was in my 40s back then. You give me $200 a week, that's all I was asking. They paid me $200 to make that tree.
I guess that's good money back then.
Yeah, pretty good money. That was just extra money. Mm-hmm. Lord have mercy, it took me a whole day just to get over it. So that I came home on late Tuesday night. I wasn't worth nothing on Wednesday. I had 2 Thursday and Friday and Saturday and Sunday the rest of the week. But and I did that while I had all the cattle. That's why I got wore out and went back to DuPont. But I didn't even sell out my cattle when I went back to DuPont. And then I got in with the hay business, and really the hay business is probably the best little old business I've been in, I guess. I'm selling a lot of hay.
That's a lot of hours, though, isn't it?
Yeah, like and you get hay wet, and it ain't worth nothing. And that's why you have cattle. If you have, you're going to have some bad hay, because it ain't going to be pretty weather every day while you're putting up hay. You get hay almost cured out, and it gets a big rain on it. It takes about 80% of the food value out of that hay. Well, you still got to do something with it. So that's what you feed to your cattle. Then you give them a little supplement on top of that. But if you're going to be in the hay business in a big way, growing it and putting it up, you've got to have cattle to feed your waste hay to. And because the good hay is all you can sell. You can't. Now this year, you can probably sell anything. We really got a hay shortage this year. And I don't know. I could sell everything I've got in my barn to daddy if I wanted to. But I've had customers been coming for 10 years to get one bale at a time. I'm talking about round bale. Mm-hmm. And I won't sell all of it out. I keep it back for them. But I tell you, the plant job is the easiest living I ever made. Working in a plant. It's a whole lot easier than working out here. Now, Bobby, you used to go off on these big jobs in like Antarctica and places like that. But, so you went to Africa too, didn't you?
Yes, yeah,
we
went to Africa.
You'd be a bit, well, sometimes you'd be gone 6 months, wouldn't you?
Africa, I stayed there 6 months, and it's supposed to have been a good paying job, but what was wrong over there? It was an American company, had the World Bank project, building a road, and the World Bank would pay the Congo government and then they get paid. Well, sometimes they couldn't come up with the money and the company wouldn't get paid, so I wouldn't get paid. So I quit after 6 months, come back home. But it was a great experience. Yeah, I learned a lot about Africa. Now that's another story. Well, I'll tell you a little bit. And that country, people are healthy, and people are poor. Where we're at, they didn't have any newspaper. Only radio they had was a battery operator. No electricity. And they had a DC power line going across the country, in which the U.S. Made it under, I think, some kind of program to hire ex-military from Vietnam, American retirees. They didn't have jobs, so they gave them a job building that power line.
DC?
DC power line, and I never even heard of it until then. You know, they had a dam, they were producing DC, and they were going across African continent. Well, I can understand why they did that, too. If they had put AC up there, everybody would have been tapping on that, and there wouldn't be any power by the time the end of the line. So at DC, they couldn't tap onto it.
Why couldn't they tap onto DC?
It's high voltage.
High voltage.
Yeah, it's extreme high voltage. And it's, there's very little electrical loss.
You're a lot quicker, too. Right?
Yeah. A lot less resistant, lost. Well, anyhow, along through there, we were about more than 200 kilometers east of Kinshasa. They were building that road, and what it was just, they didn't call it a road. It was right away to this river to build a bridge. But the thing is, they've been on it for a couple of years, and after 3 months of rain, there is no more road. And all that money that gone into building that right away, right? It was useless, a waste of money. But people, they were pretty friendly, and, and kids, they didn't have any candy, so their teeth, they had beautiful teeth, white teeth. And, across the river, there was a diamond mine, which they were supposed to build this road to that site. But people were hauling supply to this diamond site by bicycle. They would load around 200 to 300 pound sack on each side of the bicycle, and two people would push that bicycle anywhere from maybe 20 to 120 kilometers. By hand, and they take their supper. They carry their chicken, they carry their goat, they follow along.
Oh my gosh.
They said it'd take them 1 month, and I asked them how much they would make.
A month.
It'd take a month, month and a half. And they said, I asked them how much they would make. He said, averagely, $20 for a trip, two people. So I said, that's good money for them. But people were friendly, and that's one thing that was amazing to me. They were hard-working, fit, well-to-do, and I tell you what, those guys, you know, they seemed a little lazy, but I seen those African guys, they take a fully loaded diesel, 55-gallon drum, in back of their truck.
Oh, thank you.
You know how high the bed is, right? About 3 feet, right?
Yeah.
Two of them would pick that up above the drum and they would roll it. Man, they were healthy. Man. You wouldn't think they were that strong, but boy, they were really strong. Hard working.
Give me one of them orange juice and I'll see about it. Now, Marcy there, she's from tell them how you met Marcy and everything.
What's
Marcy? I mean, you're her Japanese and she's Filipino.
You want some crackers too?
No, I'll believe the secret.
Well, I won't go all the way back to Okinawa, but, well, partially. My father, after World War II, I just met my mother, and well, he got discharged. He was in Okinawa during World War II. War was over, so he came back to San Francisco to get discharged. And while he was there, there was a bunch of guys that got contracted to move all the equipment out of Okinawa, American company. So he was hired by them. So he went back to Okinawa.
He went back without ever coming home. Now, he was from Jackson County. Yeah. He didn't even come home. He went right back.
No, he did. He come back and stayed a little while. Then he flew back over to Okinawa. And because he said it was good money back then.
And then he married a woman.
Mom. Yeah.
Okinawa. He stayed over.
Yeah. I come along, so I guess he stayed and couldn't leave. And he started a business. Three guys formed the first taxi company on the island.
Taxi company.
I think it's called a Shima Taxi. Yeah, first taxi company. Three guys, and they said they were in the beginning. They were making money that was right and left, but then the drivers started making more money than they did. So they finally ended up selling it. He started a machine shop. And called Machinato Machine and Repair Shop. And he did very good.
What kind of shop?
Machinato Machine and
Machine
Repair
Shop.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was repair. And...
Then how did you end up in the Philippines?
Well, that was years later after I got out of the Navy, went over there to help him. And at that time, Dad owned a couple of pieces of property, and we sold property and had a little extra money. At first, we were going to invest and put up a rock crusher in Taiwan. And we sent the machinery up there, and we bought a piece of property. And our partner, we found out that he was tricking us all along. And after it started and bought the property, they turned around and sold the property. And when we sued him, they said, we found out in court that it was illegal for foreigners to do that kind of business. We had all the documents, we paid for the shipping, and they pleaded guilty, and we didn't get any money back, but we got our machine back. Part of that machinery was sent to the Philippines.
And, how did he know to send it to the Philippines? Did he know?
We knew some guy that had a rope contract, American guy. Yeah, he was another crook, too. Well, we sent the machinery down there, and he was able to finish a few road projects, and we got a few nice bouncing checks. Then eventually, my father liked it. I didn't like Philippines. So he had business in Okinawa, and since in 1972, when I arrived, Okinawa was reverted back to Japan from the U.S. custody. So he wanted to invest with other countries. That's where we went, Taiwan, then the Philippines.
Did your mother go to the Philippines with
you? No. I just went to Philippines to look after the start a business. And I found out right away, you know, when you first go there, they'll treat you like a king. You know, they'll welcome you. But once you invest, then you're on your own. And then you find out a lot of things that you cannot do. Like, you know, they tell you when you invest in a country, you can own only 30% of corporate stock and 70% owned by Filipino. Any kind of corporation you form down there. And you furnish some money and the technology to set it up, right? You're okay as long as the company doesn't make money. Once it start making money, then you're in trouble. It's mine. It doesn't matter how you do it. You sign over the stock certificate, you know, for 80%, whatever. The way the Philippine law is that if they claim they lost it, all they have to do is publish in the papers that they lost the certificate, they'll issue them another one. Then the old one is obsolete. Well, I didn't know this, and well, I had my partner. Eventually, I set up a crusher in Batangas, and of course I was barely making a living, but my partner, he was doing very good. He was completely broke. He didn't even have a car. He became millionaire, Philippine So I didn't trust him, so I decided to go on my own using his, the corporation, our corporation, in Turlock. That's where Aquino family is from, in that area. I set up a crusher up there, and at that time they were extending the Clark Airfield airfield. So I was getting prepared for that too. And I would say I was applying for mining right and everything else. And about 2 to 3 months before they said they would approve my mining, and I made a mistake. I had a friend from Cebu City, and I had dinner with him, and I told him what I was doing up in Turlock. He had a Filipino friend, he told him, and he brought in his crusher up there and set it up next door. And then the Bureau of Mines says, oh, my mine will not be approved yet. It must have been about 6 months, a year later, he went into production. He kept getting stone out of my claim, and Bureau of Mines complained. They said, oh, all they said, I don't see anything. That's all they said. But they threatened me. They said, if I sold one stone out of there, they would prosecute me. So I had a big old stockpile. I had to take the whole plant out, the stockpile there. I had to be there. Then I took that plant and set up another location in Batangas. And my partner, the old man, he was paralyzed from the waist down. Bertine Chavez, his name was. And after I put up the plant, he basically says he's getting old and he wants to turn it over to his son, the youngest son. When he did, I started having a problem. And at that time, I was living in Tanawan, Batangas. And he basically threatened me, so I started worrying me.
Was you and Marcia married, son?
Yeah, at that time, had the kids. And it worried me, so I transferred to Alabama, where they were a little bit more secure, a guardian area. And it got to a point where I couldn't go down there, because he says it was him, he owned 70%, even though it's my machine. Well, they kept operating until the machine broke down, and they couldn't repair it. They needed me, but I would not repair it. It took me almost 2 years to get my machinery out after it stopped. Mm-hmm. You know? Because if I pushed it, I wouldn't have been around. You know? Because a lot of foreigners, they got killed.
Really?
Yeah. That's why I say, business is good until you start making money. And,
that's a place now, young folks like y'all, I went over with his wife here about 3 years ago. Had a girlfriend. And we went to where she was raised. They call it the province, way down in, you fly to Manila 20 hours and you get on another plane, fly a couple hours and you get on a little car and go 3 or 4 more hours. You're talking about way down there, it's way down. But now, to me, it was just like Vietnam was in 1966. People, they have a tough time surviving, don't they?
No, it looks that way, but after living there, actually 25 years, Philippines, you have these kidnapping and stuff like that, and it's a good place to retire. People are friendly. And long as you're not in business, I think you can live there. It'd be great.
I know, but things are still crude, is what I'm saying. It's like the water we're talking about. That.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And
very backwards.
The water came on in the morning. You had water out on the street. Marcia's mom and daddy had a real nice concrete block, concrete house. Most of the houses around there were just little bamboo. But you had to carry the water into the house in 5 gallon bucket. I don't know why they didn't figure out a way to pump it up. You had these big barrels upstairs and in the kitchen you filled up with water. And to me it was different.
Well, what's wrong is that there is no community get-together feeling, you could say. It's all individual, what is it for me. Now, if Philippines is, I would say, is a rich country in mineral, it can be, but the problem is there's no unification of people, you know. It's individualism. And like the water system, like Mike's talking about, if the community got together and they could, even though they're poor, they could at least straighten out the water system, but it gets to the point where somebody has water in their property, that's mine, and that's it. If you want to buy it, you come and get it. Instead of developing yourself, most of the case, that's what it is. And like if you have a, you know, around here, especially in the country, you know, people leave you alone. You plant something, you harvest. But over there, when you plant something, you have to guard the, your crop. Otherwise, somebody else harvests. I remember several people, like there's one retired Navy guy, he married a lady in Bacola, where it was all sugarcane country. And he grew up on a farm here in the States. So he told the guys, he said, if you grow corn, the price of corn is so expensive, you make a fortune down there. And the people all around told him, he says, you cannot grow corn here. You can grow it, but you won't harvest it. And I said, show you how to do it. So he rented 40 hectares, that's 100 acre. And he got the seed from States and planted it. And he said he had the most beautiful crop that he ever seen. And the soil is so rich, right? So he hired, I think, around 100 people to start picking. It's that first year they come across, grabbed, and it was empty. What they had done, 100 acre people, they opened it, took the ear out, and closed it. And they were eating it. And his in-laws told him, says, I told you, sugar cane, you can eat one or two at a time, but you can't eat three meals a day. Corn, you can't. He lost that whole thing. He said he didn't get enough corn out of that 100 acre to pay for the seed. Yeah. But, you know, it's... But people are friendly. That's why people understand, Filipino understand themselves. We do not. But to go over there to retire, it's great. People are so friendly. No problem. But trying to start a business, any kind of business, it's impossible. I tried 25 years.
You know, around here, we go down to the grocery store and buy groceries. Don't think nothing new. In Laurenti, the little town that she's from over there, every morning, you just buy that day what you're going to eat. You go out in their little village, and somebody's killed a bunch of chickens. They dress them, and they soak them in ice water for a while, then they hang them on a string. And you walk down the street, and you buy your chicken, a fresh chicken. It's just been soaked in ice water. You take it home and cook it right then. You don't go to the grocery store and buy a week's stuff. The people would come down the little street every morning selling fish. You buy, if you want fish that day, you buy it that morning, you fish it that day, and you eat it that day. But over here, we just can't comprehend it. And we go to the store and buy, if you want to, you can buy 2 weeks worth of stuff. Mm-hmm. We've got freezers. And, now, they got refrigerators and stuff over there, but seem like nobody's refrigerator works.
They can't afford the electricity. That's the reason.
Yeah, I guess so.
And they got, well, the regular open market, right? You know, like a lot of the cabbage, they don't normally can't grow cabbage, like carrots and stuff, but they do up in the mountain area, so they truck it in. But, you know, they can't sell great big old carrots. They can't sell large cabbage. It has to be small, because when they buy that piece, that's the piece they're going to eat that whole day.
Right.
And the rest of it's too big to keep.
Like, what are you going to do with it?
That's right. So, but basically, if you're not lazy, people in Philippines don't starve. It's to a certain extent, they can be lazy, but it's a very rich mineral rich country. But what saved Philippines, my opinion, is that it was under American jurisdiction. The U.S. owned it, right? Till, what, 1948 or 47? American brought teachers and missionaries, and they taught the Philippine people. So basically, any place you go in the Philippines, they speak English. All their communication, the court document, everything is written in English in Philippines. And so Filipino understand English, so when the American left, Filipino, there's no industry. They tried put up industries like Japan. Repatriation, because they started the war, they gave half a dozen cement complete plant to the Philippine government. Set it up all over the Philippines. First thing they did, they stripped apart and they couldn't even set up. I don't think they ever even set up one cement plant. Except an individual company went in and set it up. All that money. Even today, you go to a certain site, you see machines sitting out in the middle of nowhere. And it's blown by the government. And it's true. But Philippines, just about any place you go, you'll find gold. And people, the farmers, this is a certain time of year, they go out there and tan gold. And, it's not much, but they do go after gold. And Philippines has the third largest deposit of chromium in the world. First is South Africa, second Russia, and Philippines is third. And they try to set it up, and they had all kinds of problems with the rebel, the union, and the local people. Oh, chromium, that's where you get your platinum.
Your what?
Platinum.
Platinum.
And there's always a trace of platinum in the chromium. But it's, and they got all three grades too. Metallurgical, refractory, and chemical, I think, yeah. And it's rich. And that industry is dying, and they had copper mine, and that's dying. And gold mine, that's dying out also. Their shoes still operating. When the American owned it, all these mines, it was booming business. But once it, they passed a law that the American couldn't own it, so it was turned over to the Filipino, and that industry went down. There's still Australian mine operating in southern part of Bipo area, and it's still okay. And that, they said that one is so rich, and they were talking about it near the coastal area. They were drilling a hole in the, near the coast, and they would pump refrigeration to freeze the wall, and then they go on. And to do that, they had to be pretty rich. You know, and they're still operating down there.
But what gets me about the Philippines, beautiful country. You get out and drive through rice, hundreds of acres of rice fields. But it's all little small places. And if you do go through a big rice field, they have a little combine. It's a little toy looking thing. I never saw any big combine. They got away going in there with these little bitty machines and combining that rice. The bigger guys, that's the bigger growers. The little growers, they go out there and cut the rice, bring it out to the highway and beat it on the pavement. That's the way they thrash it. The grain falls up, they let it lay there on the highway till it dries. The traffic's going by. I mean, it's unbelievable. You'd be going down the road and they'd be farmer after farmer to have his rice crop out in the highway, drying, because it's asphalt, or cement. And if you met a car, you had to run over his rice. But that's the way it was. That was a real experience for me, because being in Vietnam, I compared it to Vietnam. And to me, it was just identical to the countryside.
You know, compared to Vietnam, though, people, Filipino are it's a lot cleaner and a little bit more intelligent, I would say. And Vietnamese, I would say, Filipino, and they're identical people. Facial structure, identical, except a Filipino are a little bit darker.
But now, I'll tell you what, Vietnam is producing a lot of stuff now.
Of, especially rice. We're Philippines are importing from Vietnam.
Yeah, I know. Well, you go to the grocery store, you buy fish from Vietnam, shrimp and all kinds of stuff. But I don't know. But the thing about it is, we have potential right in here. If we really had to, we wouldn't have an air-conditioned place to work in. But you'd have to get out here and work. But you could have equipment to do it with. We have potential to grow anything you want to grow right here.
Right.
Really. But the weather is a big factor. Cold weather and too much rain.
Weather in special area, Gaia Farm, they got a grant, the federal government gave a grant to different parts of the United States to grow certain flowers and plant, and they got this particular grant to grow echinacea, that's basically antibiotic. So they grew it here, and they used to bring echinacea product from Europe. It was so much cheaper. But when they started growing here, they found that echinacea is anywhere from 4 to 6 times more potent than any place in the world. That's why they started producing it, and said that they don't know why. It is about 6 times more potent. And that's why
what they've got growing down here.
They usually grow more than 20 acres.
Y'all come up in the summertime when all that stuff's blooming down.
You have to make the trip. Yeah.
They have a open house every summer. You can go over and go through the plant, or you can go through the fields.
Or you can pay and go through a class. They have a class there to lecture you. I imagine that's expensive.
I went through the plant one time on my way, but I didn't go through the fields. I've been cutting hay and I've seen all the fields.
Been there, done that.
You know, I heard that Guy Farm rented part of that Mills River, that greenhouse.
Yeah, Van Lincoln.
Part of there.
Yeah, they got a big place. Over.
And then they rented a big warehouse. I don't know. Have you heard
of it? It's up in Mills River. Used to belong to Van Lincoln.
No, a warehouse too.
Oh,
a storage warehouse somewhere.
Well, it might see Van Lincoln and had warehouses and everything.
Is that right? Well, they're expanding.
Yeah, they are. They really are. And, you know, if you ever studied that Van Winkert family, now that's interesting.
I went to school with them.
Really?
Yeah, I went to school with Josh Van Winkert.
But you know, one old man come over here, and he started setting all that up, and the way you understand it, he'd give each one of his kids a different area. And that's, Van Winkert was really a booming thing at one time. I mean, it's still here for a while.
I know they do the flowers a lot, and around Christmas time, everybody goes to see the poinsettias because they have so many poinsettias out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd hate to have a little greenhouse and have to compete with somebody.
Absolutely. I think we got a good bit of stuff we can use.
Absolutely.
For sure.